Mr. Speaker, those who may wish to time my speeches will note that I'm starting 10 minutes late. I've heard MPs, Mr. Speaker, say from the age of 14 years that they wanted to be Prime Minister. I must admit I never had any ambition to be a Member of Parliament. My early ambitions were to be a New Zealand cricketer and an All Black. And if with Dan Carter out, if Graham Henry is still looking for depth at first 5-8, I'm happy to pick up the phone. I didn't have, therefore, a searing ambition to be a Member of Parliament. That might be because I went to a school called Seddon Tech, a school in those days, looking back now, for street kids, of whom much or not much was expected. But educational planners were wrong to set their sights so low for us, and some of our best teachers didn't do so. One of my classmates was Bruce McLaren, a polio victim who at 15 years of age was building a racing car in the school's engineering workshop, and he went on to win the New Zealand Grand Prix, not in that particular car I might say, although he did win the New Zealand Hill Climb Championship because it only had one gear and the car went 80 miles an hour in it. But we didn't know him as Bruce, the famous racing car manufacturer. We just knew him as Bruce, the kid with polio. I gained confidence from kids around me like Bruce, who showed that we could be anything and do anything we wanted to be or do. So I grew up with the conviction that one person could make a difference. As Irish statesman Edmund Burke once observed, all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Growing up in poorer working class suburbs of Auckland, I noticed the power pylons were in Maungaree, Otahuhu and Mount Roskill, not Remuera, Epsom or St Heliers. The sewage treatment plant was in Maungaree off Pukatutu Island in the Manukau Harbour, not on Browns Island off St Heliers or Mission Bay beaches in the Waitemata Harbour where it was actually originally planned to be. There were no Maori in the All Black teams to South Africa. The proliferation of nuclear weapons and New Zealand's involvement in wars that were clearly not ours, and in addition, were in the case of Vietnam irrational in the context of the history of that country, yet were all carefully considered New Zealand government policies. My own philosophic development through this period was heavily influenced by my conversion to Catholicism as a teenager and a resulting commitment to Christian teachings in support of social and economic justice. So I joined the Maungaree Bridge branch of the Labour Party, and the first night they made me vice president at the first meeting I went to. I was appointed to be a delegate at the first meeting I went to of the Manukau Labour Electorate Committee, and they made me president. I began to wonder at that rate whether I'd end up in Wellington as the leader of the party by the end of the next week. At the tender age of 27, I stood for and was elected to the Manukau City Council together with my socialist, or then socialist, colleague, Roger Douglas. And we set about the public purchase of large tracts of land on which to develop our new city. The idea of selling public assets never occurred to either of us. We made use of the libraries and swimming pools free of charge. And later I was elected the Auckland City Council, the Auckland Regional Authority and President of the New Zealand Labour Party. To the extreme annoyance of many politicians on all sides of politics who never forgave Time magazine, from completely out of left field, they selected me as, quote, a New Zealand leader of the future, end quote. Mike Moore particularly never forgot. I worked with Norman Kirk, who was the greatest political orator I ever heard, and later Bill Rowling when I was President of the New Zealand Labour Party. Bill was the most underrated politician I have ever known and one of the grittiest and courageous politicians I ever met. I remember Bill and I looking at grim polling news over a beer in the lounge of his leader's office in 1981, and the poll trends indicated that if they continued like that until election day, Labor would actually get no votes whatever. We actually went on to win more votes than the Muldoon-led national government, but still lost. An early cause of electoral dissatisfaction that led to the change to MMP. My message to Phil Goff, therefore, is to hang in there. Elections are not over until they're over. To beat the National Party of the day, we had to catch and roll over the much vaunted, justifiably in my view, political machine of Sir George Chapman, then the highly effective National Party president, and we did. By 1984, Labor had more than 100,000 party members, I won't ask how many party members parties have got these days, but I doubt whether it's a so-called mass membership like that. The year before, I moved from the city of my birth, Auckland, to my adopted city of Christchurch. The people of Sydenham and now Wigram have been both loyal and generous to me through four political parties, which must be some kind of Guinness Book of Records, and nine consecutive general elections. And the greatest satisfaction I've had in politics is to be able to have helped thousands of individuals and hundreds of communities in ways almost no other occupation can make possible. But it gave me no satisfaction at all to see that the government we had all worked so hard to elect in 1984 sheeted inequality into New Zealand in a way that I could never have envisaged. The gap between rich and poor widened by 127% in 6 years, 14% a year between 1984 and 90, and in my view, New Zealand has never recovered from that enormous chasm. GDP between 1984 and 93 grew by 0.5% a year on average, while the world economy was growing rapidly at the time. If you compare that to the Clark-led government in 99 to 2008, where in real terms New Zealand's GDP grew by 36%, an average of 4% per year, or eight times more than that Rogernomics period. No one says change wasn't necessary, of course, but the scale, timing and impact of change were borne largely by poorer New Zealanders. We are still dealing with child poverty, the decline in core services like education, healthcare and housing, and radical inequality. According to OECD figures, poverty in New Zealand is the highest among children, around 15% of them, and none of us in this house can be proud of that. The top 10% of households in New Zealand now own 500 times more than the bottom 10%. Members, that's the kind of society that our ancestors left in droves. Inequality affects everything about our lives. It is unfair and it is avoidable. That is why I left the Labor Party in 1989 to form the New Labor Party. I generally thought at the time, along, I must say, with almost all other commentators, that I was heading for personal political oblivion. Quite a few members of Parliament assured me with some enthusiasm that I was. But the lesson in that is that it's really worth sticking up for what you believe in. The promises broken by successive governments, both National and Labor, from 1984 to 93, led to the dramatic changes which have taken place in Parliament under MMP. I remember 93% of the population was against the sale of Telecom in 1990. And I was in this house when Richard Preble got up and said that the country was lucky to have a government of such courage that would stand up to a lobby group like that. It's no wonder that people rebelled against an electoral system that delivered such outcomes, and in choosing MMP, they did, in my view, make the right decision. Between 1853 and 1984, when I first came to the House, there had been 1,102 MPs elected to the New Zealand House of Representatives. Of that 1,102, 25 were women. Currently, there are 38 women in this Parliament, more than were elected in a total of 131 years under First Past the Post. People will be well to think on those things when the referendum is held later this year. There are now more Maori, as well as Asian and Pacific MPs. Parliament is now more like New Zealand. And if people don't like it, they should look in the mirror, because they'll see themselves reflected here. So MMP was the right choice for New Zealand, and I've no doubt that I also made the right decision in joining with others to form New Labour when I did. Then taking it into the alliance with other parties, and later, when the alliance was set to become a threat to an enlightened government rather than a supporter of it, forming the Progressives as a coalition partner for Labour. I have no regrets about any of that. Under the same circumstances, I would do exactly the same again today. There was no point being part of a party when I couldn't, in all honesty, ask my constituents at the time to vote for it. I ended up with an LEC with 24 members, 23 of whom were unemployed. How can you ask people like that to commit themselves to put you back into Parliament? And there's no point in asking your constituents for their vote if you don't intend to take on the opportunity and responsibility of being in government, regardless of the risk of doing so the smaller parties face. Because only by sitting around the cabinet table helping to make the decisions can you make the greatest contribution to the well-being of those you claim to represent. As I've often said, one bad day in government is better than 1,000 good days in opposition, and anyone who's been in both knows how true that is. I pay tribute to Helen Clark, who had the clearest and most insightful understanding of anyone I have ever worked with in politics, and to the positive difference the government she led made to this country. My term as Minister of Agriculture, as well as Minister of Economic Development and many others that, as Pete knows, too numerous to try and elucidate, demonstrated to me over and over again how the real strength of the New Zealand economy lies in innovation. Ernest Rutherford once said, "New Zealand doesn't have much money, so we have to think." And our core industries, sectors like agriculture, horticulture, forestry and fishing, are, contrary to urban mythology, all high-tech, science-based industries. Our food production ability and potential has never been more economically significant for New Zealand than it is today. Countries in our economic zone, like India and China, are the dynamic powerhouses of this century, and we are on the ground floor ready to grow with them. And they need high-quality food producers like New Zealand, like they need no other partners. I want to extend my heartfelt thanks to my wife, Carol, who has stood with me through 27 tumultuous years, and to my family and extended family, many of whom are here today, who know how much time, energy and cost all this has taken and caused. My extraordinary long-serving electorate staff, who started this journey with me in 1983 and are still with me. I don't know anyone in the House who's had the same electorate organiser for 27 years, but if there is one, I'd like to know. Jeanette Lawrence. 1990, she said to me I was going to win Sydenham, and I said, "Look, don't delude yourself, Jeanette. No one's ever done this before and it can't be done. I've booked my plane back to my manufacturing engineering company on Monday and we mustn't fool ourselves." She said, "I'll tell you, you win by 4,007 votes. I won by 4,003 and I swear to God she knew the four people who hadn't voted. Liz Maunsell, Shona Richard, Marty Braithwaite, and dozens of volunteers who help 1,500 constituents every year through my electorate office. My parliamentary staff who have worked tirelessly and well beyond what could reasonably be expected, Sally Griffin, David Cuthbert, John and Josie Bagani, and Tony Simpson, you have all been valued colleagues. I want to also pay tribute to parliamentary staff, speakers and clerks' officers, VIP drivers, who will always be remembered by anyone who's had ministerial rank, and messengers, my thanks for your unfailing courtesy and assistance over so many years. And to my former New Labour Alliance and Progressive Party colleagues who are present in Parliament today, my grateful thanks for your invaluable contribution throughout what has been a remarkable journey. Sandra Lee, who actually led the first Maori Party in this Parliament, Matt Robson, John Wright, Grant Gillen, not to mention Reg Borman, my former Labour colleague, whom I once had to persuade not to engage in a fisticuffs bout with Richard Preble at a particularly robust meeting of the Labour Party caucus in the Rogernomics era. Also my Labour Party colleagues, particularly Phil Goff and Annette King. We have been on a long journey together and at the end are now on the same side again. We have Kiwi Bank and Air New Zealand to remind us that publicly owned assets can be run successfully by high quality public service and other appointees by the government in the interests of all New Zealanders. And as far as Kiwi Bank is concerned, I will always remember Annette King's contribution at a particularly vital final cabinet policy meeting, which I've never disclosed and I'll probably get hung for doing it, but there we are, this is my only opportunity, I think. After months of exhaustive advocacy by me of the New Zealand Post business case for the bank, having to knock down every objection, and they were multitudinous one by one, Annette King finally turned to Michael Cullen after 3 hours of this and said these immortal words, quote, "Michael, Jim's beaten back every argument against the bank we've ever put up. For God's sake, give him the bloody bank." And Michael Cullen, in equally immortal words, said, "Oh, all right then." And finally, I want to mention two areas that have been central concerns for me over many years in this Parliament, where I hope that work will continue into the future: suicide prevention and prevention of drug and alcohol abuse. These are areas which are sometimes sidelined because they are complex and hard to solve, and they're not sort of sexy in the same way as many other issues that we front. Progress is often frustrating. And yet they are indicators of a community that, to the extent that it does not address the needs of some of our most vulnerable citizens, nor has the will to make necessary changes, fails in its responsibility to care for all of our citizens. And finally, to those critics, who seem pretty voluminous these days, who constantly belittle and cynically demean political participation and representation in this chamber, I can do no better than quote the words of former United States President Teddy Roosevelt, who said in a speech on citizenship, quote, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcomings. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who knows at worst, if he fails, he at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall not be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." End quote. My task now is to do what I can to help my adopted and beleaguered and loved city of Christchurch to recover from the disaster by which it has been struck. It's been a privilege to serve in this House, and I want to end by again thanking my constituents for the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.